going on here?
Okay, so it's verse 1. Verse 1, Vayomru b'nei ha-nevi'im el Elisha, Hinei na makom asher anachnu yoshvim sham lefanecha tzar mimenu. So the Nevi'im, not the children of Nevi'im, that's not really the right word, but the Nevi'im, the group of Nevi'im said to Elisha, the place that we're living in is too narrow for us. Nelcha, let us go out of Yardain, let's go to the river Jordan. The Nicha Misham ish korah achat, and let's, everybody will take one stick, one piece of wood. The Nasha lanu makom lashevet sham vayomer lechem. And we'll make a nice settlement there. And he said, why don't you go and do that? So, the question is, why? You know, what's the need for the story? It's a very short 8-verse story. It's going to introduce a miracle. Not one of the bigger miracles, but a miracle nonetheless. The question is, in what way is this story enlightening? So sometimes it's hard to say. You know, sometimes I think it wouldn't be so bad to say they were just chronicling all of Elisha's miracles because that's what he's famous for. But I think that there is an aspect to each one of these sub-stories which doesn't exist in the other stories. And what's going on here is that the Bnei Nevi'im are growing. I think that's indicated here. Because if you remember, the Nevi'im of Hashem were wiped out by Yizevo. And Yizevo is still alive, although it's hard to tell exactly, because as I'll show you a little later today, God willing, there's really Ein Mukdam Muchar in these sections, because you really don't know what story is happening first and second. And I'll show you the next two stories are essentially out of order. But I think each one speaks to a certain success that Elisha was having. And one of the successes is that the destroyed school of the Nevi'im that got destroyed during Eliyahu's time is back and forth to the point where they really can't live in their old digs, but they need to go and find a new place, essentially build a settlement just for profit. I think that's an indication of success, and I think that's essentially what the story is talking about, not including the miracle. We'll have to see what the miracle is. By the way, the word nelcha in verse 2, and nikcha is an interesting grammatical form. It is called the cohortative, and it doesn't, nelcha means let us go, and nikcha is let us take. Nikach is we will take, the predicative, which means it predicts the future, and nikcha is called the cohortative, which means the let us, let's go and do it. So you have that with Nelcha na v'na'avod et Hashem, let's go out and we'll worship Hashem. Whenever you see that ah form at the end of a verb in the future, it's usually, it means let us. In the first person it's called coordinative, in the third person it's called jussive, but either way, it means let us. Vayomer ha'achad, in verse 3, Vayomer ha'achad, ho'el na v'alech et avadecha. So the one says, sounds almost like the Matrix, the one, but what it probably means is the most significant one. Now the question is this Gehazi? So on one hand, one would not say it was Gehazi, because Gehazi was punished at the end of the last chapter, chapter 5, and theoretically he's no longer the picture, although I guess it's not impossible that he's still functioning even though he has leprosy, but that's not the implication. In fact, what Chazal say, very interestingly, in more of the character assassination that we have for Gehazi, they say the reason why the Nevi'im are about to grow is because Gehazi got kicked out. As long as there was Gehazi, he was actually suppressing people, suppressing the growth of the prophets. But once Gehazi was recognized for the bum he was by Elisha and thrown out of the prophetic group, then people, the prophets started multiplying like rabbits, so to speak, and they needed a new place. This is nice. The Chazal, of course, say it, so it's something that you know, one really needs to be concerned with. Nonetheless, my guess is that the stories may not be related sequentially, just because most of these stories are really popping in and out of disorder. If we say that this story comes earlier, then the Ha'echad can certainly be Gehazi. If it's not Gehazi, then I really don't know what the pasuk is trying to say. I guess the leader of the prophets, even though we haven't met the leader of the prophets, so it's very strange that it would use a pronoun or a, sort of like a title for somebody that we've never met before. If it was Gehazi, it would make sense to call him Ha'achad. If Gehazi is already out the door, it's a little confusing why somebody is called Ha'achad and we don't know really who it is.
Well, when we've encountered Gehazi before, it's always been a one-on-one with him and Elisha. Not necessarily part of a group.
That's true. What you say is true, and that does argue for a lack of it being Gehazi. It's true. And the other question is, why are these two stories connected? There's not even a break between. There's not even the usual break between these two stories. But keep in mind that it does have something in common besides Gay Chazi may be a common element, but another common element may be the fact that it's the Jordan River.
Oh.
And Naaman was told to go dip in the Jordan River 7 times, and these Nevi'im are saying, listen, we want to build a new settlement, and we're going to go do it out of the Jordan River.
There's
so there is that idea. What's the significance of that? I don't know. Is there something special about the Jordan River because he parted it with his staff? I don't know. But there is that in common. Both stories have the Jordan. Good evening. Both stories do have the Jordan River as their common element. So I really don't know exactly why the stories are juxtaposed. What Chazal says, they're juxtaposed to tell you that once Gehazi got out, the Nevi'im started to grow. Of course, that takes a little success away from Elisha. So I prefer not going that way, even though it's Chazal's way. So I cautiously step away from that. Because if you say that, then essentially it was just happenstance that the prophet school grew. It was a negative, sort of like a silver lining from a dark cloud. Gehazi gets the boots, the prophet school grows. I would rather say that this is just another section in the Elisha succeeding to reestablish prophecy, the fear of God, etc., in northern Israel. I think that gives more credit to Elisha. I guess the Chazal are more interested in really ripping apart Gehazi, but I think perhaps maybe what we need to do is focus on the success of Elisha here. In any event, let's continue on. The word Hoel, by the way, there may be some behind. There's
the one with the white.
That might be only later prophets. I'm not sure. Okay. You have to check the translation and see which translation's back. The question is, what is Hoel, by the way? Hoel is a good word there. Vayomer ha'echad Hoel na. Valech et avdecha. Yeah, we're on chapter 6, verse 3. Hoel na is actually a difficult word. One of the most famous places of Hoel is at the beginning of Devarim, where it says, Hoel Moshe leva'er et divrei Torah. What it probably means is continued. In which case, what he's saying is, I want you to continue with us and go with your servants, which is instead of us being a breakaway shul, so to speak, I want you to come along with us, and this way you know that even though there's a new shul in town, it's under the stamp of the original big shul. Is that topical enough, by the way? I don't know if that's a topical subject in ABJD. I'm not sure. There's another possibility for Ho'il, which is... from the word, it shows up by the Dina story, where the brothers say, no, that's not exactly the same word. It's Zotie Otu Lanu, which means if you get a circumcision, you will become acceptable to us. But I'm not sure how Ye Otu and Hoel are the same words. There might be. I'm not sure. I think maybe just continue to be with us and go with your servants. Et, by the way, is Im in many places. Et is Im. And the most obvious proof for et being im is itanu and imanu are essentially the same idea with us. Vayomer ani elech, and it says, I'll go with you. Vayelech itam, he goes with them. Vayavoh yadena vayigzeru etzim. So they cut down wood for their new settlement. There's a lot of, whenever you have a river, of course, you always have that overgrowth at a river. I don't know if you've been in rivers in Israel, but there's usually a very thick foresty growth right around the river because it pulls up the liquid from the river. Vayhi ha'echad mapil ha'korah. So one guy is chopping down a piece of wood. Ve'et ha'barzel nafal la'mayim. And what happens is he has this axe, and the barzel, which is the iron head of the axe, falls out into the water. Vayitzak, and he cries out, Vayomer, aha, Adoni, v'hu Shaul. He says, good Lord, meaning my master, as in Elisha, it is borrowed.
Why doesn't he go in after it?
Well, it's in the Jordan River.
Yeah.
Can
swim?
Yeah. At the bottom of the Jordan River.
Someone can
swim. Might be
heavy. At the bottom of the Jordan River, I don't know. It's question, but
some places it's inches deep.
Yeah.
We saw a baptism there.
Oh yeah, really?
Yeah.
I think some places are pretty deep. Also depends on the season, of course.
Yeah.
You have the snow coming down, so we'll assume that it was deep. Otherwise, you wouldn't be so upset.
There was a group there in front of us, and they were baptizing people.
Where were you?
They put on raincoats to go into
plastic
raincoats to walk into the water with their clothes on.
And the minister is had
with their coats on?
With the raincoats.
Did you tell them that it's a chatzitza and it's not a good, it's not a good,
I don't think it kept them dry.
No, of course not.
They dunked themselves completely
maybe
in the water with a raincoat
just to cover them. Their nakedness.
Oh, so they don't get
so.
They
were
wearing clothes.
So maybe they were afraid that the clothes would get wet and show through or something.
The clothes did get wet.
What was the point of the raincoat?
This is an opportunity you could have asked. And did you get pictures, by the way?
I have a theory. Maybe they were being modest. They figured that when the clothes got wet, you could see through them. They figured they would cover up
the men did too.
And this was in the Jordan, I guess, on the edge of the Jordan River.
And the Jordan River was about as wide as this room.
Yeah, it is. Sometimes in some places it's very thin. Yeah. That's true.
This
it is. It gets thinner actually down to Jerusalem, because it gets drier and saltier as it goes down,
yeah.
I think. In any event, so he, you know, what's strange here is, Aha Adoni is this. No, that's okay. No. It's all right. You're not finished with the. I didn't mean to cut off your story. Aha Adoni is a very powerful statement. Aha is like a call of pain. It's used when things are going really, really bad. It's a very strong. I mean, the guy lost his. You know, his axe. I mean,
but it was because of his fire.
That's correct. So the assumption is that he wouldn't be able to pay back the person. And iron was obviously big then. Here you're pretty decently into the Iron Age. This is the year about 850. Iron Age starts at about 1100, but no doubt that iron was still pretty expensive. So no doubt he's concerned. But it is sort of like an axe. You know, it's a strange.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the same force of. I think I'm underestimating.
You're
thinking of it from your standpoint.
Yeah.
Right, so where I go to Home Depot and get another one?
Very, very costly things.
Yeah.
And I thought it was how they have to sharpen it.
Right.
They have to sharpen it against stone.
Right.
He says that the axe is borrowed. Not even his.
Correct. I think that's the issue, is that it's so expensive, he'll wind up going into debt with the payback. Okay, all right. Vayomer Ish Elohim, Ano Nafal, where did it fall? Vayareu El Makom, and he shows him the place. Vayiksov Eitz, and he cuts a piece of wood. One assumes the size of the handle, because it flew off the handle. Vayashlech Shama, he throws the handle into the water. Vayatzaf HaBarzel, and the iron floats to the top of the river, and he gets his iron back. Vayomer Haram Lach, lifted up. Vayishlach Gado, and the prophet goes and reaches out his hand. Vayikachehu. It's like, but it's a little like, it's so like so much ado, and there are details here, and it seems so overwrought for such a little game. For instance, why do you ask him where it fell? If he's going to do a miracle, he needs to know exactly the spot that it falls in. It's a very strange thing. Like, what do I need to know exactly where it fell for? Vayiktsov H, and I need to do, so obviously something had happened. He threw in the piece of wood, and I suppose the wood, so I'll tell you what Chazal said that two miracles happened. Wood, which normally floats, sank to the bottom of the Jordan. The size, they cut the size of the H so that it would act as a raft for the iron. The iron fell on top of the eight. What? Or what's that? And it's as if it's.
The iron was there first. It's part of the miracle.
Right. Yeah.
Vayomer Haram Lach, go and pick it up for you. I mean, what did the guy think he was supposed to do? I don't know, stare at it while it floated down the Jordan River? There's so much going on here for a little thing. Vayishlach Yado Vayikachayim, and he stretches out his hand, he takes it. Sounds, this of course goes back to Moses, to Moshe. As I said, a lot of these things, they have these motifs.
Gotcha.
Yeah, bots, right, as if she's stretching her hand out for Moshe Rabbeinu, like axe Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, on one hand, as I mentioned before, almost all of his miracles have been done in such a way that one could argue away that they are simply extensions of nature. his breathing into the boy's mouth, and his doing it seven times, his throwing the wheat onto the pot of bitter food so that it would make it taste good. Many of his miracles are, in fact, nearly natural. And therefore, he may just be going out with the same motif as, I'm not going to pull a big miracle, I'm going to do something which could be mistaken for nature. And in fact, that's what the Ralbag says. So the Ralbag, the Gersonites, Rabbeinu Levi Ben Gershom, who was a philosopher, he was a Neoplatonic, he was a Neoplatonic philosopher, lived, I think, around the 1200s, maybe mid-1300s. So he has this whole thing, what happened? Why did they have to say he cut the wood? He cut it into the same exact shape as the handle. That's why he had to know exactly where the barzel was. And he threw it in really hard. So he goes against the idea that the wood was a miracle, the wood, like Chazal said, that it wouldn't float. And it nails the hole of the axe perfectly. And because it was a really big handle, which floats, so it managed to bring up the whole barzel, which means it was barely a miracle, it was just a good shot put, essentially. That's what the Ralbag said. The Ralbag always wants to minimize miracles in the Torah and reduce them to a bare minimum, in which case the Ralbag would say that it was a miracle, but as in all miracles, it was a miracle that was merely nature, just a slight, slight deviation or extension from nature. And then I guess the story is really more of a moral story about what Elisha did for his people rather than a miracle. Now, I just want to read you the Malbim. That's the Ralbag.
Ralbag.
We'll call the Gersonites.
Ralbag doesn't know too much about physics.
What's that?
He doesn't know too much about physics.
Why is that? Why do you say?
Well, because first of all, iron doesn't float, and wood does float.
Well, that's what he's saying.
Right?
That he's saying that the wood, it was
so,
he threw it down
the
really hard.
The axe, the is much lighter than the axe itself.
Well, what if it was a really big handle? What if it was like a really big handle? Would it do it?
It would have to be very big.
Uh-huh. So that's what he's going to argue.
It's just not. I mean, I have an axe at home, and it's very heavy.
Right.
And the wood part is like,
maybe this was just a little
light. So okay, so you could argue that. So I mean, the Gersonites, right? I'm sure the Gersonites would try to. Well, each one was only cutting down one piece of wood. And as you said, it was hard to come up with a good axe back then, so maybe it was a small tool. I'll just read you what the Malbim says. Now, just to give you a little feeling on the Malbim. The Malbim is a very distinctive. He was a great, great scholar. He became a chief rabbi of one of the towns in Hungary. He was a great scholar. He is the only Parshan, as far as we know, who wrote, and this is the 1800s, who wrote on every single book on Tanakh, bar none. Maybe Radak did it, but the only person that we know for sure did it was the Ralbag. Nobody else is matched. Even Rashi didn't do it. The Malbim is the only one who succeeded in writing an entire parish, and not a little tiny parish, big parishim, and sometimes double parishim. On Shir Hashirim, he follows the rather common, really not uncommon path of giving two interpretations. One is the metaphysical, and one is the literal, what is the love story.
What age period?
1800s, the Malbim. In fact, he conflicted with Reform Jews. He was very anti-reform. This is Hungary, Germany, that time in the middle 1800s, late 1800s. And he really came and confronted reform Jews and was pretty rough with them. I don't remember exactly the story was. There was some story about a non-kosher meat place. Oh, I remember it was. Huh. He said that in his, and he was the community rabbi, that any meat place that would sell its kosher meat place, that would sell its kosher meat to a Reform Jew, that store owner could not get an aliyah in the shul. Could not really become part of the shul. Yeah. He was not, He was not, so it wasn't just, it wasn't just the people buying it, it was
the cure of man.
The rejection was, he felt that there was a war, this is the rise of, this is Mendelssohn, the rise of Reform Judaism in Europe.
Right.
He felt that it was a great enemy of the Jewish people, which it's possible that he wasn't so far off, and he decided that instead of trying to do a little cure of work, he would simply confront the problem by throwing it out the window. Needless to say, the reform started smearing him, and the whole thing didn't work very well. He didn't have an easy life. He did not have an easy life.
What was his point? I don't understand. What
his
was
point
the,
was
not
to that essentially a reformed Jew, you should have nothing to do with them. You shouldn't even sell me kosher meat. And if you sell me kosher, your kosher meat, hopefully I'm getting the story right. I'm pretty sure I'm getting the story right, but I may be getting it wrong. But I think it's right. But if a kosher, I'm afraid that I'm overplaying it because it is shocking, but if I'm not mistaken, that's exactly the story. That's going to sound really silly on the tape. I believe he was simply saying that anybody who has anything to do that shares, like in the religious process with a Reformed Jew, is a traitor against Orthodoxy, and therefore we have nothing to do with you.
Strange thinking.
Today we would never do something like that, but...
No, but even then...
Maybe there was a guy who wants to come in and take extra money for kosher food.
He felt that Reformed Judaism was an enemy of the Jewish people, and
yeah,
honestly, in the late 1800s,
guy who paid extra money
but
for
this
kosher
isn't
well,
Reformed Judaism. This is a person who wants to eat a kosher piece of meat.
Well, I believe he was a Reformed Jew. He belonged to the Reformed Jewish.
Okay, but still, he's eating kosher meat.
I can't defend.
I don't think he's out here to defend.
Yeah, it's not right. It's not entirely fair. I'm simply telling the story. The only judgment we can make is he was obviously a crusader of Orthodoxy against Reform Judaism in the late 1800s. It's hard to judge him whether he's right or wrong without knowing the full story, and I may even be mixing up the story a little bit, but I think it's right. I don't want to judge him too harshly in that sense. I just want to tell you that he was not a guy to take prisoners. He was not a guy to take prisoners in his Parshanut HaTorah. So let me read to you this little bit on this miracle. Everybody ready? It's pretty funny, actually. Let me just read it to you. This is the Malbim. I forget his name. I can look it up at the beginning of the book in a second, but let me just read this to you. Here it is. Vayiktzov ha'itz, and they measured out the piece of wood, which means they cut and measured a long piece of wood. This proves that the prophet had the ability that to show that nature is opposite in both ways. The properties of wood and iron were exchanged, were swapped. The wood sank to the bottom of the Jordan River as if it was made of lead. He's quoting, of course, very poetic. It sounds like Shirat Hayam. Barzel tsaf lamala ke'etz kal, and the iron floated up. He doesn't say the wood lifted up the eights. I said that because why else throw down the wood? Apparently because the wood would sort of get under the barzel and lift it up. That's a pretty good miracle. What he's saying is no, the wood was simply thrown in. The wood didn't come up, and the pasuk never does say that the wood comes up. It just says the barzel comes up. What does that mean? That the wood was there to show that there was like an exchange, like a positive-negative type of thing. Like the minute it touched, like matter and anti-matter swapped
energy,
all of a sudden.
The energy
was switched from one to the other. Very strange,
from the
right?
Wood to the,
yeah.
The metal.
The properties of one became the other, and the properties of the second became the first. And now listen to this. V'ha'ralbag chipes b'zeh tachbolet tivim kedarko. And the Ralbag has looked for the usual natural connections as is his wont. V'dvarav hevel. His words are worthless. Just hot air. This is the 12th miracle that we're counting so far in the miracles of faith. But as you can see, he's a take the prisoners type of Udvarav Hevel. His words are essentially hot air, empty hot air.
Who's he talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Whose words?
The words that Malbim is saying, the words of the Ralbag, when he tried to find some natural foundation for the whole thing. They're simply a waste of space. So it's a very sharp thing to say. I thought I'd give a little taste of the Malbim there. I'll look up that story.
He's considering it's just a miracle.
Yeah, and not as so what was the point of the wood? He said he knows what people said before him. He says don't confuse things that the wood somehow got under the iron or got into the iron. No, the wood was there to demonstrate that the wood stayed on the bottom of the Jordan River. It was like it's called a zero sum system. Right, if you have like energy and matter, so however much matter disappears in the universe, it has to replace with that much energy, and vice versa. So here, if you want to call this like a metaphysics, he had to almost like quasi natural. He'd have to throw in one thing to receive the properties of the barzel, so the barzel could receive the properties of the eight. Of course, the question is then, was it good for chopping down trees anymore? So now I got a floating piece of barzel. Was I able to use it, or is it now essentially a useless piece of wood?
It was
what's that? You hit the tree with the tree, essentially.
You hit the tree with the handle.
But the, well, yeah, but the handle got stuck in the water, so now he's got. The only advantage would be, even though it's a worthless piece of, theoretically, if it's kept the property, it's a worthless piece of iron, at least he could give it back to the guy who lent it to him and say, hey, you sold me a defective piece of iron, it's like a piece of wood. I'm not responsible for this. So I don't know exactly.
Maybe it was just to show that the river wasn't throwing everything off.
Well, it's possible, it's possible, you're right. I was looking for something more sort of metaphysical to it, but either way, it's just this interesting little, it's an interesting little episode. What does it really teach? My guess is, in the big run, what it really teaches is, again, the nature of the miracles that he did, which were kind of quiet, simple miracles that help people get along. That's very typical Elisha. Why do we need another one? And therefore, I'd say the only thing that really makes this story distinctive is not the miracle so much, because we've seen this kind of light, relaxed miracle, which is close to nature. But what's interesting is the very fact that the Nevi'im are spreading. That, I think, is the most important. That justifies the telling of this story. The very fact that the Nevi'im are coming back, I think that's an important idea. Because they said this place, wherever they were living, was no longer big enough for all of them, and therefore they had to go and essentially build a new settlement in some free territory down by the Jordan River. That indicates that either the both birth rate, assuming a number of years, as well as people just coming and joining the Nevi'im, hey, knocking on the door and saying, I'd like to go to Navi school, I'd like to be part of, I think I got something in me. And what you see is that it's gone so far as that they really need a new settlement. And I think that by itself justifies this parak, even without the miracle. But I could be wrong. There may be something in the miracle that I don't see.
By any kings.
That's correct. Absolutely right. Yes, they're, yeah. They are by the Jordan River, so it's not entirely clear whether everything is copacetic, but it's clearly better, and there's no, one thing is for one thing's not for sure, because we don't know exactly when the story takes place. It's possible that Yezebel is still alive. But if she is, it means that the power balance is starting to turn. Don't forget, Eliyahu pulled off big miracles, and the next day Yezebel was chasing him right out of the country down to the Sinai Desert. Here, if Yezebel's still around, while she still has obviously some power, she does not want have enough for Elisha, and as far as people know, Elisha's not even pulling off miracles. People just figured, oh, he threw a piece of stone down. How come he had to ask exactly where he was? It was a real miracle. He would have said hocus pocus, and out comes the water. You know, out comes the iron. So I think Elisha was really on the QT in most cases. It was his personality that was bringing in the fans and bringing in the power. It wasn't his. Fire and brimstone. Right. Let's continue on. Verse 8. This is a very interesting story. We're not going to finish chapter 6, but that's good, because chapter 6 really goes into chapter 7. Umelech Aram haya nocham b'Yisrael. This is a great story, by the way, and it teaches more about Sefer Bereishit. Again, there's a reference to Sefer Bereishit, but this time I know how to play up the reference a little bit. Umelech Aram haya nocham b'Yisrael. So Melech Aram made war in Israel. Now, we have no idea when this is taking place, but I will show you that it's from this pasuk. It's surprising, because one would have expected the name of the king of Aram to be mentioned, like it was before, and that was Ben-Hadad. Here, we do not know what the name of the king is, and I'm going to show you that this is actually towards the end of Elisha's life. And Yehu, who rebelled against and overthrew the kingdom of Omri and Ahab, this is probably 20 years later, and I will try to demonstrate it at the end of the chapter. But again, it's the point of the story which is important, not the historical aspect. So he takes some advice with his servants, and he says, "El makom ploni almoni tachanoti." I love that, by the way. It's very poetic again. Remember, we always had rhyming Ben Hadad. Remember when he was drunk? He was like, "Im l'shalom yikachum chayim." He's always been very playful. So there's a little bit of artistry, and he says, "Let's go to this place. What we're going to do is make a machaneh. We're going to make a camp at this place." Now, what's interesting is normally a translation of ploni almoni is just whatever, wherever. Like, you have that in Sefer Rut, Ploni Almoni. Ploni. Ish Ploni. Right? Or Ploni Almoni? I don't remember.
Ploni Almoni is a typical, John Doe.
Right. Now, remember what Chazal said about Ploni Almoni is that he wasn't just a John Doe, that Shmuel in Sefer Rut was suppressing his name because he didn't do the mitzvah of Yibum like he was supposed to, and therefore, as a punishment, just like Yibum is supposed to extend the family line, a lack of Yibum essentially kills the family line. There's a sense of being unknown. Here, too, I think that's a good proof, that Chazal's understanding is a good proof, because here, Ploni Almoni, what he's going to do is he's going to set up a secret place where to attack the Jews. Whenever the Jews walk by, or the king specifically, he was setting up essentially this jump spot, this ambush. And so therefore, Ploni Almoni doesn't sound like just any place. It sounds like a hidden secret place. That's So that supports, I think, Chazal's reading in Sefer Ruth a little bit. Vayishlach ish Elohim el melech Yisrael emor. So he sends, so the man of God, that would be Elisha, sends the king of Israel. He says, Hishamer me'avor makom hazeh. Don't go by this place. There are bad people there. It's a little bit like if you go to Florida, so they started putting up little sunshines on certain exits. I don't know if you know about that. There was such a problem with the cars used to be labeled as rental cars. And there was a tremendous amount of hijacking down in carjacking down in Florida. And there's certain places, like if you go to Overland, there are a few places in like where you get off the exit and you're in the worst neighborhood you could possibly imagine. I actually got off by accident in a place called Overland. It was a terrible spot where people literally hang out in corners and eyeing you as you're driving by. So Florida did two things. One is they took the there was always a special symbol for rental cars, so that I think it was like a Z or something that came off. And what they have is, take a look when you're there, little sunshines. And where there's an exit marked in sunshine, that's safe to go. Where there's no sunshine, that is not safe to go. That's
really?
What they do. Absolutely. Well, I believe it still exists like that. I believe it was not successfully challenged as being essentially racist. It's racist. It is. On the other hand, it's also realistic because the bad towns in Miami are really, really bad. And that's what they did for quite a while.
They're very discriminatory.
No, the bad... What? It is. There's no doubt it's profiling. However, it's people literally getting off on the wrong place and disappearing. There were cases of people being killed. I don't know if you remember. This was about 10, 15 years ago. There was a German couple that got... That's exactly right. They got up, but it was not just a German couple. It was really quite a rash. So they did the sunshine thing. I think the sunshine things are still around, but don't quote me. But I know when I was there about 6 or 7 years ago, I remember seeing the sunshine. No doubt about it.
There was a whole series of planes and boats that were hijacked, but I didn't realize that they were taking cars there.
Cars, carjacking, yeah, going to the wrong neighborhood, that's it. And also what they would do is, they would on the highway, they would recognize, cars from rental people, and they'd crash into them, fender bender. Mm-hmm. They would get off the car, and they would get off on the side of the road, and then get carjacked, or just be robbed. This was really a problem.
Even happening here.
This was in Florida? This was in Florida?
Yeah, in Florida. It was a rash. That was happening here as well.
Accidents, and then getting you to get out of the car, and then
robbing.
Well, I guess because tourism is a bigger issue, so they figured prey on the tourists because they really have no frame of reference and no.
They don't know where they are.
Yeah, and they don't know.
They shouldn't get out of the car.
Yeah, right. Tourists and naivete definitely go together. Having been a tourist, I know. So anyway, so he says, don't go to the place Kishamar Am Nechitim. That's where they're waiting for you. Vayishlach Mal Yisrael Amakom, Asher Amar Lo Ish Elohim, Vehizhiro V'Nishmar Sham. So the king sent to this place, and they and what Radak says, V'Nishmar Sham V'Nishmar Misham. Apparently what the king did is he sent to the local battalion, the Jewish battalion that was there, that they should stay away from this place. Not only would the king go, but he told the soldiers to stay away from this place also. This also tells you something very interesting, where, again, I know I've said it again and again in the course of this forum, but you have to read between the lines. What this means is that Syrian troops had freedom to operate inside of Eretz Yisrael, and even deep inside, in places where the king would normally go with his troops. So this gives you an indication. Now, nowhere does it say that the Jews were losing the battle and people were being killed and people were being captured. But obviously, if they're strong enough to be able to put in traps within the state of Israel, so you have some weakness politically. Anyway, so let's continue. Lo echad velo shtayim. It happened not once, but it happened twice. That is, every time they put down a thing, at the exact same time that the Syrians put down their trap, the Jews stopped going on that way, either to the same place in multiple times or to different trap areas. Vayisa'er lev melech Aram al davar hazeh. The heart of melech Aram was very stormy. He was very upset about this. Vayikra al avadav. He calls to his servants. Vayomer aleihem, halo tagiduli. Tell me right now, mi mishalano al melech Yisrael. Who among us is working for the king of Israel? So he thinks what one normally thinks. There's a spy in his midst. Every time he sets up a plot, every time he sets up an ambush, the king gets word of it. The king of Israel gets word of it. There must be a spy who's letting out the secret coordinates, which is a reasonable guess. Vayomer achad me'avadav. So one of his servants says, "Lo, Aduni HaMelech, you got the whole thing wrong. Ki Elisha Navi Asher b'Yisrael." You know how they know it? Because Elisha is a prophet in Israel. Yagid l'melech Yisrael. He always tells. Now, Yagid is future tense, but obviously it means he regularly tells the king of Israel, "Et hadvarim asher tidaber b'chadar mishkavecha." If you say it in your sleep, like you tell your wife a secret, he knows. There are no secrets from Elisha. There are no traitors here. You have a prophet problem, not a traitor problem. So what do you do if you have a prophet problem? Of course, you try to take out the prophet. Vayomer lechu re'u echohu. Go look where he is. Now, echo is a very interesting word, because echa means how, usually, from the word ech. But it is actually twice used, echo, as where. It clearly means where here. The other place is in Shir HaShirim. Echa tireh, tell me, my lover, where you will shepherd your sheep. So obviously it's a use. It could be more Aramaic use. It's hard to say. The Malbim, who is very, very careful that every word in the Torah is meaningful, he believes in really super meaningfulness. That's the Malbim's big thing. Not an extra word, not an extra letter. So he says, Echohu, not only does mean where he is, but how does he operate? So he puts in the word how, but it's not, I don't think it's necessary. Va'ayishlach ve'ekachehu, and I will go and I will take him. And what's also interesting here is the Malbim is playing up the nice side. He's saying, I don't want to kill him. I just want to bring him on my side. How much is the king of Israel paying you? I'll pay you double. that's how the Malbim puts it. Why does the Malbim take such a good view of things? I'm not sure what to say, maybe because of what will happen later in the story. Vayugad lo leimor hinei b'dotan. It was told him he's in Dotan. Dotan, of course, is the place where Yosef went to look for the brothers. Yes. Again, well, this is probably the dozenth time that we've had a motif or words which remind us of Sefer Bereishit. We've seen this over and over in these stories. There are these recollections of book in the Torah. Now, it could be just Elisha loved teaching Sefer Bereishit and Shemot, so he liked to use motifs as much as possible. But I suggest there's something deeper. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Who's being compared? Does that mean that the king of Aram is being compared to Yosef because Yosef was looking for his brothers? I mean, it's a little who's... I don't understand that. What?
They weren't in Dotan.
He's not going to find them either.
Well, I mean, all these just mentioning the name of the town.
I know. If it was only Dotan by itself, I would have said, it's just the name of a town. But this has got to be the 10th, the 12th, the 15th reference to words that are taken directly from Sefer Bereishit in these stories. So I don't know. It's a little bit too much of a coincidence. The problem is I don't know what to make out of it. I mean, I don't know. Just for the sake of teaching a Sefer Bereishit, I don't know. There must be something deeper here. Maybe something Kabbalistic. I just don't know. I don't know what it is. Vayishlach shama susim berechav chayil kaved. So he sends horses, chariots, and a great army. Now, normally, when horses, chariot, and great army show up, that's usually to cause somebody to die. And the reason why you send those kind of troops is because you're sending them deep into Eretz Yisrael. Dotan is not too far from the capital city of Shomron and the great city of Shechem. The assumption is I'm sending in a massive expedition force in order to take him out. Of course, that's not what the Malbim says. The Malbim sticks to what he said before, which is it was an honor guard. Okay, I don't. You'll see why perhaps that's true, but I think the Malbim is not right here. Vayavo Laila, they came in the middle of the night, which also does not indicate a friendly gesture. Vayakifu al ha'ir, they surround the city. Vayashkem sharet ish Elohim lakum, so the servant of the man of God, Elisha, gets up. That's the use of Ish Elohim. Now we know it's Elisha because Elisha was mentioned in the previous passage, but the fact that it keeps calling him Ish Elohim is also very strange. You know, who is that? Who are they comparing to? Moshe Rabbeinu or maybe Shmuel? In any event, the Mesharet gets up. Now, is this Gehazi? Probably not. But again, every time we mention a servant, you know, this, by the way, could be a refuah. If you remember, what did I mention at the beginning? I mentioned some weeks ago that the problem was that Elisha was always using middleman to do his stuff, Gehazi, and that caused him trouble. It could be now the fact that he doesn't have a named servant, maybe that indicates that he wasn't trying to set somebody else up like Gehazi, so maybe he learned from a mistake that he made. I just don't know what to make of it. So he goes out of the city and like, who? And he probably closes the door right again. He said, we got ourselves a little problem. Aha, Adoni. Do you recognize those words? Those are the same words of the guy who lost his axe. Now I could see, aha, Adoni. I'm surrounded, the city is surrounded by a massive army of Syria. Now I would say, aha, Adoni. There's clearly a connection between the two stories. What exactly is the connection? Don't know. Echa na'ase, and here again the word echa is used in both places, once by the Syrian king and once by the... There's all kinds of things going on here to connect all these stories. It's beautifully written. I just wish I knew what the point of the prophet poet was. Vayomer al tira, do not be afraid, Elisha says to his servant. Ki rabim asher itanu me asher otam. We got more than they got. We got a bigger army than they do. And now here's the really nice part. Vayipalel Elisha vayomar, and Elisha prays and he says, Adonai, God, pekachna deinav vayireh, please open his eyes, i.e. the servant's eyes, and let him see. Vayifkach Adonai et einei ha-na'ar, and Hashem opened up the eyes of the servant. Again, na'ar, so it does not mean child here. Vayar v'hinei ha-har malei susim v'rechav esh, and the whole mountains were surrounded, that is, surrounding the city with the forces of Syria. Surrounding the forces of Syria were horses and chariots made of fire. Svivot Elisha, and they were all surrounding Elisha. Now this sounds, which means the cavalry is here. And of course, once you see chariots of fire, you immediately think of who? Of Eliyahu, right, who left the world. So apparently Eliyahu has come back in some form, and he is ready to take on the forces of Aram. But the strange thing is, the focus doesn't seem to be on educating Aram. The focus seems to be on educating his servant. Isn't it strange? The servant goes out and goes, aha, Hashem, what are, you know, aha, not Hashem, aha, my master, what am I supposed to do? And he says, you're not looking at it right. And he prays to God that his prophet will have some insight. What does this indicate? Again, perhaps that he was just a wonderful teacher, which is why he went with them and helped them out on their little things and their big things, and he helped them whenever. And maybe he's just a pedagogue. Maybe he's just a guy who's interested in teaching his prophets how to see correctly. But it is a very strange... What's that?
He's got to teach them faith.
But it's not really faith, because in the end he shows them the miracle. He shows them that the chariots are around them.
Right, but
he's
got to have faith
them vision.
That they're there, even if you don't see
I guess
them.
So, perhaps. Yeah, you're right. But he is. He's an educator of his people. He's a... And by the way, the chariots never show up to Aram. They never know that they're there. It's there to give confidence to the Na'ar.
Oh.
Why? Because what's going to happen to Aram right now has nothing to do with these chariots. You would expect what's going to happen. All of a sudden, the chariots of fire come down and they wipe out the forces of Aram. Never happens. Never happens. They do something else entirely. Let's see what they do. Vayar elav, vayardu elav, and the chariots come to him, i.e., I assume to Elisha. Vayipalel Elisha el Hashem, vayomar, hach na et agoy hazeh besanverim. Hit them with sanverim. Now, the only other time that I know of sanverim showing up in the Torah in this use is by Lot. By Lot. Do you remember the story? Let me read you the story. Lot is surrounded by the enemy. They're all pushing at the door to get in. And what does it say? Let me read it to you. I don't have it here. That would be chapter 23, I think, or 24 of Bereshit. Is that right? No, chapter 22, maybe? Where is this story? I lost my place. Where is the story of Lot? That's right. Oh, right. A second. Okay, here it is. The two angels. It's chapter 19. So they want to take out the men to sodomize, which is why it's called sodomy, of course, because it happened in Stone. And it says like this in verse. Here it is, verse 9. Vayomru gesh hala, vayomru vayifzeru ish balot. They all pressed against Lot because he said, essentially, take my daughters, not the people. And but they wanted they wanted these two men. Vayikshu lishbora dalet, and they went to knock down the door. Vayishlechu ha'anashim et yadam. The people stretched out their hands. These would be the angels stretched out their hands. Vayaviu et Lot aleihem habayta. They brought Lot inside. Vetadel et sagar. They closed the door. Vayeta anashim asher petach habayit hiku b'sanverim. And the people around the house, they hit with sanverim. Mikaton v'ad gadol. From little to big. Vayilu limtzor patach. They were not able to find the door. Now the English translation here is blindness, which is the usual translation. But it can't be blindness. First of all, even in the Lot story, it shouldn't be blindness, because even if you were blind, you'd still be able to find the door. You see what I'm saying? That's the weird thing. They're all around the door. They're all pushing to get in. The angels hit them with blindness. Right. So that seems to be what's going on. But over there, you can't tell, because all it says is that they hit them with sanrim, they weren't able to find the door, and therefore most translations go with blindness. Most translations. Here, you're going to see that the word sanrim means something completely different, and Elisha is essentially teaching us Sefer Bereishit by using the word sanrim. So let's take a look and see what it is. Vayakem b'sanrim kidvar Elisha. What happens? Vayomer aleim Elisha. So Elisha then says to the army, Aram's army, lo zeh haderech, you got the wrong road. Velo zeh ha'ir, oh, and you got the wrong city. She's pretending just to be some guy that they meet. Lechu acharai, come with me. V'olicha etchem al ha'ir asher tivakeshu. And I'll take you to Dotan, the city that you're really looking for. V'yolecham tom Shomrona. And he takes her to Shomron, which is the capital city of Israel. V'yihi kivolam Shomron, they come into Shomron. V'yom Elisha, Adonai, pekach et enei elu v'yir'u. Let the eyes of these people be open and let them see. Now here is the same words that he used by his servant when he wanted to help him prophesy. It wasn't the prophet was blind, so he couldn't see the chariots of fire and the horses of fire. He wanted to show him something he was not capable of seeing. So now he makes the same prayer again, but this time to demonstrate to the army of Aram that what they're seeing was not what they should have been seeing. So then he prays to God, he says, open their eyes, they'll see. The army has just been able to see the truth, and all of a sudden they're sitting and surrounded by the armies of Shomron, which means Sanverim can only be translated, in my humble opinion, as a glamour. As a glamour. When somebody, a hallucination, somebody, it's not that you're blind. It's that you think you're in one place when you're in fact in a completely different place. It's called a glamour, when you're really under the impression that you're seeing something and you don't see it. They can see. They're standing out in Dotan, and all of a sudden they have no idea that they're in Dotan. They think they're in the wrong place. The guy comes out, at least comes out and he goes, excuse me, you got the wrong place? They're saying, Dotan? They're like, oh, wow, you're right. It doesn't look like Dotan. Come, let me take you to Dotan. And they're all wandering after Elisha while he takes them like the Pied Piper. And they're walking to Shomron, which has got to have battlements, and they don't see that. They don't see it. And all of a sudden, they walk into Shomron, and Elisha prays that they'll actually have vision, sight. And all of a sudden, they see the truth, which is that they're in the middle of Shomron, which says Sanverim cannot be blindness, which makes sense back by Lot. Why? If you're at the door, you're smashing in the door, right? And let's say you get hit by blindness. So what? So I'll do this. And it's that hard to find the doorknob? I don't understand.
Yeah, but you're not going to be able to do much.
I'm sure you would. I think there'll be 100 people surrounding the house. I'm sure they would have figured out something if they were blind. It doesn't say, by the way, that they were blinded and they all ran away in fear. It says they were blinded, the low young hold themselves to doubt. They couldn't find the door. That doesn't make sense with blind. Well, it does a little, but what makes more sense is what it means is they thought the door was a tomato or something, or they thought a door was a rock. Now, you can't prove that by Lot, but here you could for sure prove it, because he says, oh, he doesn't say they were blind. He's saying, this city, that's not Dotan. Let me take you to Dotan. And he takes you to Shomron, and they think Shomron is Dotan. They have no idea. They're walking into the capital city of Eretz Israel, so northern Eretz Israel. That is hallucination. That is when you're looking at one thing and you think it's completely different. Although in the case of the Navi saw reality, and he wanted to teach them how to see super reality. And in this case, they were seeing a false reality, and he wanted to show them the truth, which is that you're walking into the middle of Shomron. It's just there, again, those same words being used over and over again. But there is a case where essentially you can't translate the word Sanverim. This translates as terrible. Why is it terrible? Because it didn't look at what Elisha said the word Sanverim is. Unless it wants to be Cholik on Elisha. I guess it has the right to be Cholik on Elisha. But with Elisha, the word Sanverim clearly means a glamour or hallucination. Or an alteration of the mind, not blindness. You can't say blindness. By the way, what does Sanverim say in your English translation there?
Blind.
It says blind? Can't be.
Yeah, it uses the blind. Blind.
Yeah, that is not a good translation. Most of the Mepharshim say, you know, will say right on the spot that it wasn't blindness, they were confused. But I like the word glamour.
Well,
I think it's a very nice word.
Here in the commentary,
go ahead.
It says the noun
Sanverim
occurs again only in Genesis.
Correct. Over by Lot. And that's much better. I don't know why they would even bother sticking with blindness, because blindness is unlikely even by Lot, because again, why could they find the door? And here it's impossible. They simply weren't. But there were chariots, there was a whole army. It wasn't like they were blind and they were saying, we'll follow you wherever we're going. They obviously weren't blind. They would have thrown down their weapons.
Yeah, but you know, in English, you know, you can be blind to a concept. You can be blind to understanding that that your kid is really out taking dope when you think he's in the library.
Okay. Wow, that's quite an example. I don't think that's the intention of the... I like the word glamour. I think it's a beautiful word. It really fits in perfectly.
Yeah, I've never heard of
G-L-A-M-O-U-R, glamour.
Like glamorous.
One who's glamorous sheds a spell over somebody and causes them to see something that isn't necessarily. I believe that's the etymology of the word.
Okay,
it's not G-L-A-M-M-E-R. I don't think so. I think it's G-L-A-M-O-U-R. The reason why I know this, I apologize. The reason why I know this because I used to play Dungeons and Dragons quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
and one of the magics that they have, one of the spells that they have, is the glamour spell, which makes somebody see what they were not expected to see. Of course, there's Arthurian legends. You have there in Le Morte d'Arthur, you have a glamour where somebody was expecting to see one thing and they saw another thing. So it goes back to my fantasy and Dungeons and Dragons days that I know this word, not my knowledge of Tanakh. But it's so obvious here that it's not blindness, unless you want to euphemize the word blindness there. But I don't think that there's. I prefer to say the translation is simply wrong. I just don't like the translation. I don't even like confused vision. I really think it's an alternate vision. Why? And why do I say that? Because the words that he wants to cure their alternate vision matches the words of his servant prophet when he goes from seeing reality to seeing something wondrous. I don't think it's just a question of thinking, sort of like not getting things quite straight. I think it's literally seeing, like, well, I think that's what it's hinting at, but I think it's more than just confused. It's alternate or phantasmal.
This guy
alter perception
and tells them, you know, you're all confused. Follow me. They don't know that this is Elisha.
They don't know who he is.
How are they going to find him?
They're just in a state of, I mean, I don't know what to say. Just their minds are not working properly.
They
probably knew Elisha. Yeah, but also, why would
they?
Even if they did, they must have thought that this guy was dressed, when they looked at him, they probably thought he was dressed like a general of the Aram armies. Why else would he? Or unless they thought he was just some guy who was hanging around. By the way, there's similarities. What's that? Yeah, I guess perhaps they didn't know it was Elisha,
but their perception was very altered.
And the whole thing was it's very strange. And by the way, of course, this is one of those things where Yosef shows up and he can't find his brothers. And he goes to this person who is a malach, who is an angel, maybe. And the angel says, oh, they're up there and they're doing the thing. There's similarities here. I just don't know what to make out of it because it's not clear. I don't know who's who. And if there is a comparison, it's not clear what the comparison is. Anyway, we're already running over time. Let me just finish the story. We're almost done. Pasuk Chafav. Vayomer HaMelech Shamar Elisha Kiroto Otam HaKeh Avi. Shall I wipe them out? Now... Elisha, right. Yeah, my father. Correct. Correct, but this is actually Menachem Litek spoke about it. He taught me this, which is that this cannot be Achav's son Yehoram. Cannot be. We'll find that Achav's son Yehoram wants Elisha dead. He doesn't like him. He's not a firm guy. He doesn't like talking to him. He'll talk to him because he knows he's a prophet, but he would never call him Avi. This is Yehoram. We have not met Yehoram. Yehoram will be the one who leads a bloody rebellion and destroys the house of Achav, including Jezebel. This has to be...
Yehu.
What?
Yehu.
What did I say? Yehoram?
No.
I'm sorry, Yehu. This is Yehu, the son of Nimshi, who will lead a rebellion. We'll meet him in about five chapters. This story must be in Mukta Mukhabitor because there is no way that he would have taken, not only asked for advice from the prophet, but called him Avi. There's no way that a son of, and we'll see, by the way, the next chapter will be Achab's son. We'll have it explicitly, and he ain't calling Elisha Avi, he's calling Elisha a dead man, actually. So there's just no way that this is, anybody but Yehoram, but Yehu.
So who is saying my father?
The king is saying to Elisha, my father, what should I do?
He's calling Elisha
my father. And that's where you really see that not only, again, this is one another step in the story. Elisha has not only, you know, he's helped the poor, he's helped his people, he's converted his people, he's helped everybody. And finally, at one of the last miracles that he pulls off in this arena is that even the king is asking advice for the prophet before he's willing to wipe his nose. Yeah, tremendous honor.
Yeah.
So this is another step. Elisha is successful in every single way. Now let's continue. Avayomer lo takeh, do not strike them down. Ha'asher shavita b'char b'char b'kashtacha tamakeh, after you've taken a captive, with your sword and with your arrows, you're going to strike them down. This is classic Geneva Convention, really.
Mm-hmm.
Saying it's a moral lesson. You want to wipe them out. You can't wipe them out. They're prisoners.
Well,
they walked right in.
For?
What's that? Oh,
well,
so we'll see. We'll see exactly what he has in mind. Sim lechem v'mayim lifneihem. Put water and food in front of them. Lechem in this case doesn't mean bread. It means food. Like beit lechem is in Arabic. Laham is meat, not bread. Vayochlu v'yishtu v'yelchlo adoneihem. Let them eat and be merry and the whole thing and go back to their master, the king. Vayichlehem kerag dola. Now these are very difficult words. Vayichle. Everybody guesses it means they put food in front of them. It turns out to be a very ancient Ugaritic term. Ikara. And it means to a massive feast. That's how it translates there. That's a good translation. Vayochlu vayishu vayashachem vayilchu adonim v'lo yasvu od gedudei aram v'vo beretz yisrael. They stop coming in. What is Elisha doing? Elisha is really trying to do the same thing he was trying to do with Naaman last week. He wants Syria on the side of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He wants them on the side of Israel. He wants to make peace. First he tried it with Naaman. It didn't work out because of Gehazi. And now what he's saying is not only are you not, it's immoral, I think what he's saying is not only is it immoral to attack people that come to you peacefully, you're going against your own interests. This way they're going to go back and they're not going to come at you again. Now in the next verse they're going to come at them again, but as I mentioned, that's earlier in time. This is a later story. So you don't have to worry about the contradiction there. Radax just says that it was for a while. Oh, doesn't mean never, it means for a while. But you don't even have to go there. Why is that important? And I'll end with this idea. I've spoken about this before, once in Sudat Shlishi. The enemy is not always who you think it is. Elisha maybe knows what's coming. Right now, Assyria of Sancheirev and all the people who can destroy Israel, or try to destroy half of Israel, they're on the rise. They're not yet a powerful country. Right now, you might think that your major problem is Aram, and that's who you have to destroy. And if we wipe out 1,000 troops, that's better. They walk right into our capital city, wipe out 1,000 troops, will be better in the long run. I think what Elisha is prophesizing without saying it is, no, you don't act like that. You act like this. And if you act moral, you send these people back, then you make a friend out of Aram. Because the truth is, the only thing that stands between Assyria and Israel is Syria. Is Syria. How did it work out in the end? So it didn't work out in the end so well anyway, but it may have bought them in at 50 years, another 75 years. It's always hard to say what's going on. But I think Elisha's message is, you think that you can make the biggest deal by showing what a big, tough, massive guy you are with big strength and you can wipe out this army? That's not how you make peace. That's not how you make peace. Give them food and water. You know what? Give them a lot of food and water and wine and let them drink and they'll go back to their master and they're not going to bother you again because you'll have one people in the geopolitical world. And he was right. For as long as it worked, it worked. And that was that's Elisha the prophet. He's a wise, I wouldn't call him a pacifist, of course. I wouldn't, because there are other stories where he's going to show that he could be quite cruel or quite, he could wage war when necessary. But,
Right there, that's not peace now.
What's that? Look, I think probably some people would probably criticize Elisha for being a pacifist, but my guess is after years and years of war under Ahab, people are probably happy to see a little bit of peace. Anyway, but anyway, that gives you a real good idea of the personality of Elisha. He's quite the character, Elisha. He's quite the character. Have a good